pick it up. You are listening to Punk News Podcast episode 529, the ska adjacent episode, or the episode about the ska book. Let's pick it up. And welcome back to Punk Podcast. We're going to have a lot of ska tone picking up jokes because we're going to be talking about ska a lot this episode. First of all, as usual with us here is contributing editor Adam White. Adam White, I know your ska go back deep, back to the 90s, back to the 80s. Adam White, are you ready to talk about ska?
I'm so excited to talk about ska rather than whatever other crap we normally talk about because that's just us. You know, re-arguing our own politics in an echo chamber, and people don't want to hear that anymore. People want to hear about ska.
That's true. People do want to hear about ska. And we are also here with two ska veterans, ska maniac, and ska scholars. Scholars, S-K-A-L-O-R-S, scholars. We are here with Aaron Carnes, who's got a new book coming out. It's called In Defense of Ska, down on Clash Book. And actually, I mean, it's already getting a lot of press and a lot of pre-sales, Aaron says. And Aaron, when's the book come out?
May 4th, 2021, so just a few months.
May 4th. Aaron, man, what's happening?
Not much. Just trying to spread the word of ska, just so, you know, to get all you people to stop talking about all this punk garbage and start talking about ska.
Well, see, I would argue that ska is a subset of punk, unless you're talking about Jamaican ska. But unless you're talking about Jamaican ska, then I would say ska is a subset of punk. And we're going to get more into this, but Aaron was in a band in the 80s called Flat Planet, which was a regionally popular band from Gilroy, California, just south of the Bay Area, or maybe that technically is the Bay Area. But now he's one of the top dogs at the Santa Cruz Weekly. He roadied for Skank and Pickle, and he's got this new book called In Defense of Ska. What's really cool about the book is, like, the Keith Morris book, I read in a day because it's such an easy read and it's great. The Harley Flanagan book I read in a day because it's great, maybe 2 days. It's great and it flies by. Aaron's book does not fly by. That's because it's an extremely dense book. But what's cool about it is it's got, I don't know, maybe 50 chapters. And each chapter is kind of an independent story about something that happened in the underground ska scene, more or less. So I really, really dig this book because you can read this chapter or that chapter in, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes. It's really informative. But there is an insane amount of information in here. This is one of the most researched music books I've ever read. So if you like ska or obscure punk, this book's for you, man. And this book's rock. We are also with – quite welcome. I mean every word. We are also here with Adam Davis. Adam Davis was also briefly or less in Flat Planet for not quite as long, but he was also in a band that a lot of punk news readers and listeners know. Link 80, he was one of the main Link 80 dudes, I guess, on Link 80 phase two, if you will. And if Adam can correct me if I'm wrong. But then after that, he formed one of my all-time favorite bands, which Aaron was also in, Darby's, the crazy, I guess you would say, art punk weirdos, one of the weirdest bands I've ever seen live. And we'll talk about Narboots a little bit. And now he's got a band called Omnigon, which is popping. Adam Davis, you're having somewhat of an off moment in that your third band coming back swinging, people are digging it. How's that feel?
It feels really good. It's nice to be back doing something that kind of harkens back to my roots a little bit more, since familiar territory.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about ska in a minute, but we have to address the elephant in the room. And what it is I sense passive aggressiveness from Aaron Carnes to Adam Davis. And here's why. Adam Davis and Aaron Carnes were in Narb. The third guy in Narb was Bob, who I liked a lot. Bob is actually an amazing master. And I actually had a master through the punk, three of the punk tapes and the Flames CD. And he did an amazing job. Like, he made the Flames CD sound amazing. And he's in a band called Yulia. And we always like write nice things about Yulia and the bands that he's in. I like Bob a lot. The weird thing about Bob is this is on Punk News out of the blue a lot on Twitter. And it bothers me. And it really shouldn't. I mean, like, I shouldn't let like that eat at me, but I do, you know. And the weird thing, Adam White, is Bob was talking trash on punk about 6 weeks ago, and Aaron Carnes clicked like on it on Twitter.
I gotta support my boy. I gotta support my boy Bob.
John, have you hijacked this conversation to litigate your social media grievances? Because,
well, I mean, in a way, yes. Here's why: because I like Aaron and I like Adam and the palsy wows when I lived in the Bay Area. And to be frank, that palsy wows has died down a little bit when I'm back out the East Coast, understandably, you know. But then I see my boys. I was Darby's fan number one, talking trash on Punk News. I will not lie; it bothered me. And that's why I'm bringing. See, if I didn't really care, let it sit there and be cool about it. But I'm addressing it because it bothers me, and I want to know why my pals are stabbing me in the back.
Damn, Aaron, what do you do? See, I didn't even see any of them.
Yeah, but see, you're just as guilty, Adam. And here's why.
Okay, go ahead.
Is because you know, Brooklyn Vegan's been posting a lot more ska punk, ska stuff this year, last year, which is cool. And this is not anti Brooklyn Vegan. I like Brooklyn Vegan a lot. There's the guy Andrew Thatcher over there. Nice guy. I am very pro Brooklyn Vegan. But Brooklyn Vegan's posted about Asian man bands, ska bands, which is cool, and I'm glad they are. And all these bands are like, yeah, we love Brooklyn Vegan. We love Brooklyn Vegan. Funk News has been posting about these bands for years. Peeps from those bands. Not a peep, you know? And so what I think is everyone's like, oh, the cool girl's talking to me now. I'll go hang out with her. But, you know, you don't miss the water till the well runs dry. That's what I'm saying. So I'm just to your guys' perspective, but where are you guys standing? You know,
I mean, with the Punk News posting, you know, over the years, it's kind of a the situation with it, at least from my perspective, was that, you know, people like you, John, were always very kind to us. But then there were people like EZD2 who were not kind to us, and people who were trolls, and made any time that you were mentioned on Punk News, it became a moment where you were being open to ridicule. And to people simply typing meh as a comment on something that you'd worked on for over a year. So that's probably why some musicians feel a little bit off about Punk News. It's not that we don't like Punk News. It's that it comes with its own special brand of hazing from its readership. And I feel like that's died down a bit. Maybe some of those... some of those commenters maybe succumbed to COVID. All I'd like to say to that is
hopefully
good riddance. It's not that we don't appreciate you, John, but it is nice to get recognized by a different website that I thought only wrote about like hipster bands. So it's nice to see our bands get written up there. And it's nice to like we're hip.
I just like to throw in there that we, Narboot, wrote the official Punk News theme song. So I do think we've earned ourselves a little bit of credit in this department. So if we talk a little trash, I think we've earned it.
See, but that's what makes it hurt that much more. Is that you're right, Adam. I mean, Aaron, rather. The Narboot Punk News theme song opens the first punk mixtape. And then my boys, who I thought by were ride or die boys, are stabbing in the back. However, Adam White, check this out. Adam Davis makes a good argument in that my perspective of punk is that it's just the writers and the editor. But Adam Davis's perspective is that he's seeing it from the front end, not the back end. And he's saying that whenever I get written about, I get shrapnel, and I don't even want to engage with that. And he's not, I guess, sifting the writers from the readers. He's seeing it as one unit. Adam White, is he telling me what I want to hear, or is he giving a truly earnest, different perspective that may be a valid stance?
John, you can't tell people how they feel. So you, your perspective from the back end of this is super unique in the universe and totally skewed. So I really is also reflective on the amount of, you know, personal mojo that you're injecting, you know, into the site and into how much you're identifying with it as well. So. I don't think anyone can share your particular perspective on this. You have to just go by the way that people are going to read it. And there's been some horrible shit that people who comment on Punk News have spewed out over the years. And, you know, and that stuff that in a lot of cases predated and pre-existed all the places where we expect there to be horrible comments these days. You know, like no one bats an eye too much about, you know, the fact that like a YouTube, you know, comment section is a cesspool, but the kids, we always take it as, you know, part of the course for YouTube. But, you know, Punk News had our cesspool running like years before there was a YouTube. So there's, you know, we kind of have to own that. We pioneered the garbage pile, John, is what I'm saying.
And that's my beef with you, Adam. You never stick up for Punk News. You always defer to the Punk News criticism.
Yeah, John, well, I'd like to take a step back. I feel like you have your own identity wrapped up a little bit in the Punk News.
You did too identity. Much, you say.
I mean, because I 100% back John Gentile.
Yeah, if it was John,
even though
John
I can
Gentile.
Never say your last
com.
Name right.
Yeah.
See, but are you guys telling me what to hear? Because I've got you in an ambush.
That's not true. I would say that, you know, with Punk News, there always comes that grain of salt, that shrapnel, that feeling that you're about to catch one in the neck. But with John, I always feel like my favorite memory of John is when Narboots played a show at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma. And we got on stage with the Mini Bosses and played Rise Above. And I remember John coming straight to the front and to like represent for the crew, for the team. And that's the John that I hold strong and high above in my head. This figure of strength and friendship and power. And you know, Punk News is a different thing, a thing that John inhabits and throws around and dominates. But I would never claim to say that Punk News is Punk News is John. I would say that John bends Punk News to his will.
See, that would be a nice thing to say, except for I wasn't at the show at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma, Adam.
You weren't.
No, I was
sure?
At, but
which song am I thinking about then?
924 Gilman, which actually was a crazy show. Let's tell a crazy Narboots story. And then listen. I accept Aaron and Adam's explanation. It might be what the
Aaron was John at the Phoenix Theater show.
No,
I know he was at most of the shows. I want to interject. This is one of my first Punk News experiences as a band. You wrote an article about us, a great article, and this one comment stuck out. I think it was shitty dude, shitty band, shitty dude, and that's all it said.
Shitty band.
To be clear, that wasn't my comment. That was a reader comment.
Yes.
Yeah, we're talking about the experience of being written about by Punk News. On one hand, amazing article by John. And then on the second hand, shitty band, shitty dude.
Now here's the, let's break that down. It's only four words, but shitty band, fine. You know, being a shitty band is one thing. Shitty dudes, like, yes. That cut deep.
I will
especially,
say,
especially
I'll
when
I'll
it's all
here.
Three dudes.
I'll interject
here. All three dudes are shitty.
Adam Davis and Aaron Karn, not shitty. Great, I would say that.
Oh, but where's this going?
It's not going anywhere. I'm just saying, let's set the record
straight. What about the third one?
Oh, Bob? I'm angry at Bob. I am angry. I mean, I'm not like burning cake at Bob, but I don't understand why Bob would go out of his way to diss Punk News when I've paid him to mix stuff, told him he's doing an awesome job, and cover all his band. And if he didn't like Punk News, I think he would just keep it to himself, but he's take a first lead in dissing on Punk News, and twice over the past 4 years ago, I've just been writing like blah 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 Punk News, and then he remarks to my tweet without me even mentioning him, crashing on Punk. And honestly, that's the last time I used him for mixing, even though he's an amazing mixer, and I think I do recommend him as a mixer. People are looking for, I mean, a mastering guy. People are looking for a mastering guy. I don't know where Bob's fresh comes from. I suspect it might actually come. Is linked into Mike Huguenor, because I think Mike Huguenor might have a beef against Punk News too, and I don't know why. I don't know why. We've been extremely pro Jeff Rosenstock, extremely pro Yulia, extremely pro Hard Girls, but there's some kind of beef there, and I suspect what it is they want to be seen more as like an indie rock sonic youth kind of guy, and they see Punk as dorky or uneducated or uncouth, when I would argue we're more intelligent than all those descriptors. So that's my personal beef.
John, are you saying that those guys might need to watch their backs?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm just saying, but like all those guys are very, you know, peace and love, man. Peace and love. You know, let's treat people equally. You know what I mean? But they're the ones starting beef where I'm not saying anything. I've never said anything bad about any of those guys, you know.
Aaron, would you agree?
I would say this is quite an interesting discussion about ska.
Adam, what were you going to say?
I was going to try to talk you off the ledge about ska a little bit, but
so listen, boy, I'm glad we had a discussion. I like Adam. I like Aaron. I accept the explanation, and let us call a truce in the name of ska. Let's talk about ska. How about that?
That sounds lovely.
Aaron, but
I think we should revisit this bit about Bob a little bit later.
That's fine. I wish I could let stuff go. You know what I mean? Like, what do I care if Bob's talking trash from Punk? What does that matter? I mean, Bob doesn't really affect my life whatsoever. But it just annoys me that I feel as though I've been very nice to Bob, very well, and he, like, bites me in the back. You know what I mean? That's my perspective.
You know what I think you need to do? So Bob and Huguenot and another of their friends has a podcast about the Ying Yang Boys.
I'm not going on that podcast.
You have them on the show, and then you can air your grievances.
I want you guys on my show because I like you guys, and I think you guys are both great musicians and great writers. Aaron's a great writer. Adam Davis is a great music writer, sure.
My book just hasn't come out.
What's your book?
I have until May, right, Aaron?
May 4th.
May 4th. That's when his book comes.
Well, now that the beef is resolved, Aaron, let's play a tune and come back and talk about why we're actually here. Talk about your new book, In Defense of Ska, by Aaron Carnes.
Sure, sounds great. You want to play some Skank and Pickle? We'll do like I Missed the Bus or something.
Let's do it.
To go to work at 9 o'clock, it takes me an hour to stick my hair up.
But why?
Why do I always miss the bus?
I miss the bus. I miss the bus again. I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
Now, why'd you miss the bus?
I don't know.
Oh, were you up late last night?
I guess so.
And were you watching TV?
Uh-huh.
What kind of TV?
Magnavox.
Well, that's no excuse for what?
For missing the bus. I miss the bus again. I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
My boss said to
me, you know, good run, he's grown toenail pus. Why do you miss the bus?
I miss the bus again. I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
I have not used yet.
Because I always miss the bus. I miss the bus again. I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
Why'd you miss the bus?
I don't know.
Were you up late last night?
I guess so.
And were you watching TV?
Uh-huh.
Bet you're watching Three's Company.
Yeah. Because I love Three's Company. I love Three's Company. Company,
but that's no excuse for missing.
I'm missing the bus. I miss the bus again. I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
My boss said,
you know, we're gonna run these wrong bus.
I miss the bus.
I miss the bus,
and I had no excuse.
I miss the bus,
and there was nothing I could do.
I miss the bus,
baby, go dragging away.
I miss the bus, and there was.
I miss the bus. I miss the bus again.
I miss the bus. Yeah.
And we are back, and we're going to talk about Aaron's cool new book, which I talk about, which is packed with info. Aaron, you talk about Skank and Pickle a little bit in this book. What was it like touring with Skank and Pickle?
It was a lot of fun. I think the thing that was unusual for me at the time was I had already toured with Flat Planet a few times, and we did DIY touring 100%. We played weird venues. We slept in people's houses. Sometimes we just slept in the van. Skank and Pickle at that point in 95 were surprisingly big. And I didn't really realize that until I went on the road with them. But they were a very professional operation at that point. They stayed at hotels. They were on a pretty like clear schedule. And they were drawing huge crowds. I mean, in San Francisco, when they would play Slims or something like that, it would be packed, but it would be 500-600 people. In the Midwest, where we toured, they played at Prince's Club, First Avenue, which has got to be like 1,500 people. They sold that show out in advance. That was the moment where I realized how big Skank and Pickle were in 1995. To me, they were just my favorite band, you know, a local band, friends that I'd come to know. But to the ska world, which was just before ska went mainstream, they were probably maybe Mighty Mighty Boss Tones was the only band in the ska world bigger than them. It was, you know, it was a shame that they broke up shortly after that.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. You talk about just before ska went mainstream, and that actually circles back to your book, In Defense of Ska. I mean, did ska going mainstream – well, first of all, would you agree that in general music discourse, the concept of ska is tainted? Like you could say, yeah, thrash metal. Everyone's like, yeah, thrash metal rules. You could say hardcore punk. Everyone's like, yeah, hardcore punk rules. You say, oh, ska, people kind of chuckle, you know.
Yeah.
Do you agree that within the stream of mainstream music discourse and even underground music discourse, ska is somewhat of a tainted item?
Yeah, I think that ska, the way and the timing of ska going mainstream is totally tainted it. I don't necessarily have any problem with the individual bands that got famous in 96, 97, but I think it didn't serve the genre. The bands that were chosen, the way they were marketed, and the way, all the bands that were kind of forgotten about around them, because part of what was appealing about ska in 94, 95 was the quantity and diversity of bands. Yeah, you had goofy bands. Real Big Fish already existed in, you know, 92, 93, but there was also bands that were really political, bands that were serious, bands that were writing interesting alternative rock meets ska, bands that wrote personal music. It all existed in a nice way in the scope of what ska was before it went mainstream. But when it went mainstream, it kind of like narrowed it down to saying like these kind of lighthearted, goofy bands are what ska is. And that's what most people digested the genre as.
Do you feel as though the taint towards the ska name, and actually we'll get to the response to that or modern tactics that in a minute, but the taint to the ska name, was that because ska, I guess, got too bloated and brought it on itself? Or did outside forces pin, you know, kind of the goofiness or the silliness on ska, whereas other genres like hardcore didn't necessarily get pegged by that by outside forces? You know, forces, be it music publications, fans, or whatever.
I think, you know, a lot of people like to point out that ska did it to itself, you know, with all these kind of young high school marching bands that, you know, kids that weren't very good, that were emulating, you know, 90s third wave bands. I don't think that's a fair way to blame what happened to the genre, because that happens to every genre. Kids get into the genre and they're not very good at it. And that's just a normal thing. And that's just part of what happens. Excuse me, just a second. I'll pick up in just a second.
Aaron is so overcome with ska that he's breaking down in hysterics?
No, but what happened was the mainstream cherry-picked the bands, and the mainstream marketed it in a certain way that said to people outside of the scene, this is what ska is. And, you know, there wasn't really much you could do with that once it kind of got rolling. Once that just became the narrative, and then ska was was placed as a trend, like the latest trend. It's hard to imagine in retrospect thinking of ska as the latest trend in 1996, when not only did two-tone happen in the late 70s, but ska had been in the U.S. underground scene since like 81. So it had been in the U.S. for 15 years before it was became the latest trend. So it's ridiculous to think of it as the latest trend. That just didn't really work, I don't think.
I'm looking at a portion here in your book called A Brief History of Ska Selling Out. And then I'm going to throw it to Adam White after this question. But you focus on the impression that I get by Muddy Muddy Boss Tones and also Date Rape by Sublime. And also, actually, you mentioned Time Bomb by Rancid, of course, and a little bit of No Doubt here, too. Listen, Sublime is a massive band, and they still sell massive t-shirts, and the Sublime brand, if you will, is worth a lot. To that end, you know, people outside of the Sublime world love to bang on Sublime, saying it's this stupid bro band, you know. I think Sublime is an amazing, clever band that references reggae, ska, and pretty obscure stuff, too. And they also morph it and bend it into their own thing. And I think that band is far more clever than the vast majority of people give them credit for. And I don't think – I mean, I think their fan base is kind of bro-y or frat boyish. The band itself, I think, is a great, incredibly interesting band. What's your stance on Sublime? If I recall, you're actually anti-Sublime. Am I right?
No. I like Sublime a lot.
Oh.
I like Sublime a lot, but I don't like the song Date Rape. And I trash on that song a little bit.
Yeah, but why? See, Date Rape is an anti-date rape song. People think it's a pro-date rape song, but it's anti.
I'm not saying like the song is problematic. I just think it's a terrible song.
Oh, and really?
It's just a bad song. I think Sublime has so many better songs. And in fact, I like most of the songs that Sublime, the singles that came off the next album. I think most of those songs are great. But I just think Date Rape's a terrible song, and it's, in my opinion, that's just like a terrible example of ska that got really popular in the 90s. That was one of the very, very first ska songs that became a radio hit. And whatever. It's just a corny song, in my opinion. I called that section of the chapter A History Selling Out. That was just a tongue-in-cheek. I wasn't like slamming on that. I was just giving a history of how ska became a mainstream thing. And I just kind of charted the timeline of things because it was – Date Rape and Time Bomb were the two singles that got big in 95. No Doubt was happening at the same time, but I think No Doubt weren't really doing ska, so it's kind of a weird thing to bring No Doubt into the conversation. Yes, they were a ska band in the 80s, but when they became famous, they weren't really doing ska, so, you know, yes, they came out at the same time the ska was happening, but I'm not really sure why they're in the conversation at all, to be honest.
Actually, you in your book, and I will let Adam ask a couple. Adam has some questions, but two questions for you, Adam, Aaron. Rather, you bring up a very salient point in regards to No Doubt history. People tend to think of Tragic Kingdom as a semi ska album or a faux ska album, and they say, But the two albums before that are ska albums. But you make the point that the first No Doubt album, which I think is just called No Doubt, it's actually a funk rock record. It's not really a ska record at all, which I think is very true. And people always forget about, you know.
Yeah. And wasn't their second album, Beacon Street, like a collection of older songs? I feel like that's the case. I mean, I think they were new recordings, but I think the thing was with No Doubt is they were pretty much out of the ska game, you know, by the early 90s. And that's fine. A band could do whatever it wants. I mean, there's nothing saying that a band needs to stick to ska, but I just think, you know, and Tragic Kingdom isn't a semi-ska album. There is no ska on that album whatsoever, so that's fine. I like Tragic Kingdom. I think it's a good record. It's just not ska record. It doesn't really belong in the ska dialogue, in my opinion.
Well, you have to admit, man, Gwen, she's the greatest, right? Right?
Yeah, great. I love Gwen. I love No Doubt. And I love their old ska stuff. I love their non-ska stuff. No beef whatsoever. I just think it's just weird to bring them up, their mainstream stuff, in the ska conversation because it's not ska at all. It's not what ska sounds like.
Adam, what you heard, Aaron Carnes hates No Doubt and Gwen, and he hates any band that's not ska. How do you respond to Adam White, a noted ska fan?
John, I thought we were past the point in this show where you were going to air your particular beef, and I think I think your defense of No Doubt is trending down that path.
Well, to briefly interrupt you, Adam White, I will say that myself and the Narboots boys have a faux competitive relationship. And in reality, that's because I like them that much. If I actually had a beef with them, then I wouldn't do a faux competitive stance, if you will. Go ahead, Adam.
I'm just an observer, so I have to take that for what you're saying.
Sorry, I'm coughing. I just dealing with all your guys' Scott hatred. No, I was kidding.
Scott destroys your insides, so it's just it's just something that happens. I'm curious, as you were speaking to a lot of people, how much you got a sense for how strong and relevant was ska from the standpoint of it being not just a pop cultural phenomenon when it broke in the third wave in North America, but a specifically regional phenomenon. Because I remember, you know, getting into it through the same kind of goofy radio hit ska that everyone else did at the time. But it wasn't too long before I'd zoned in on what they were doing at Stubborn Records and King Django and all like the really interesting genre stuff. I don't even know if it was all that successful, but like that was just like that I couldn't hear anywhere else. Like, you know, he was mixing, you know, klezmer music in with it and everything else. And you went and you looked at the way that his output with Skinnerbox and the Stubborn All Stars went out and informed what was going on with the Slackers and all of them. And it really felt like there was a New York thing that I should be paying attention to at the time. Was that, did that actually manifest itself when you were out and speaking to people? Like, was this a regional phenomenon primarily?
So before ska was mainstream, it was definitely very regional, and especially it was regional in the 80s and the 90s. I think that regional quality continued on, but I think because bands were touring more and more, there was more overlap. But in the 80s, touring was not something that was easy to do. So a lot of these bands came up in a scene where they heard the Two-Tone Records and they really got to see each other's bands. And, you know, secondarily, they would hear about bands in other cities and maybe, you know, there would be some touring. But yeah, so New York in the 80s was not a punk ska city. It was very much rooted in two-tone, traditional ska and jazz stuff. That's what was happening in New York in the 80s. When you look at other cities, different things were happening for sure.
Now, you didn't set out to target a single scene or even a single era, really. I mean, the book is in defense of ska. You've got the whole genre on the table there. Was there much of a worry on your part about how to be comprehensive? Because you're spanning, you know, you go way back to the 60s and everything. If you're really going to do that. So did you try to hit all eras, hit all places, or did it just flow as it flowed?
Well, I worried about that too. Not so much for the output, just more the how do you put together something comprehensive because there's too much information. So it kind of made it so I couldn't write the book. But when I kind of let that go and decided that it was going to be deliberately not comprehensive, that I was just going to focus on what I wanted to focus on, whether it was because these were bands I liked or these were stories that were interesting to me or ones I felt hadn't been told, kind of freed me up to just go forward. And in doing so, I think I did, you know, I focused on what I wanted to focus on, but I then tried to fill in the lines around it just to make it clear the comprehensive elements of it. Like, I didn't go into detail about Jamaican ska, but I did give context for how the music came from Jamaica and some of the stuff that was important to understand about it without spending a whole lot of time there, for instance. And that was the approach I took.
Was there any artist or scene that you approached here that was tougher to crack than any of the others, or was everyone kind of freely talking?
Everyone that talked to me was very open to talk. I wasn't able to get everybody, for instance. I mean, you know, I couldn't get to Mighty Mighty Boss Tones or some of the bigger bands. I mean, I did talk to Real Big Fish, for instance. They actually weren't too hard to get a hold of, and Less Than Jake and some of these other bands.
Is that a sly diss? They actually weren't that hard. Are you dissing Real Big Fish, Aaron?
No, I'm not dissing them. I'm just saying, you know, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones and Real Big Fish are probably touring the same spaces. I mean, maybe Mighty Mighty Boss, especially like 5 years ago. So I'm just saying I didn't know Real Big Fish would be easy to get, you know, to be able to talk to and have easy access to, but it turns out that it wasn't that hard. Whereas Mighty Mighty Boss Stones was difficult.
So, I mean, I want to just bring the Boss Stones up here for a second, because they just released, they just started working with Hellcat, actually, to go like tie two unconnected, you know, third wave threads together. So they've gone and they've signed on to Hellcat, and they released their first song that was part of that, part of that, this new era, I guess. And it's this massive, like 7 minute guest packed thing. And John and I were listening to it, and the thing that struck us the most, like musical qualities of the song aside, is just how much of a nostalgia trip it was meant to be, and how much that they were really writing that for the fan from that era as a little bit of a defiant, you know, like, we're still here statement. And then, mm-hmm. you know, looping in everyone that they could from that era. So you've got that, where the Boss Stones are just, you know, without any shame, trading on the nostalgia for what was going on in third wave. And then I'm trying to unpack that, because like the people from that era may just be the right age now that they're all fondly circling back to that. But it gives me pause about, like, well, where's this going? Because it's one thing for all the old bands to start writing records about how great it was in 1997. But I'm curious, what's your perspective on where the life is now? Like where things are coming from? Like I guess by the nature of approaching people that have history, you're going to be looking back at the past, but did it give you any appreciation for where things are going?
I think 90s third wave ska nostalgia is very safe right now. People are interested, and people do want to talk about it, and they want to do it in this way that, you know, is reflecting on the stuff that was popular. I think that the Boss Tones timing was not risky at all. I think if they had done this 5 or 6 years ago, it would have been definitely way more risky, and they would have definitely possibly not had a receptive audience, or that would have been the risk. But then clearly there was an audience for that now. So you can take that either as like, well, they took the easy decision doing it now, or that, why not do it, you know, when people want to hear it, sort of thing. You know, when I started this book in 2013, that's when I first started working on it. There was no interest in ska at all outside of the diehard ska fans that were still into the music. And I mean, even nostalgia stuff. Nobody was going, oh man, let's talk about that, Real Big Fish album in 1997, or let's talk about the which Boss Tones album was the greatest. I mean, this just didn't exist at all. A friend of mine, Taylor Morden, who did the film Pick It Up, Ska in the 90s, I think, I don't know if he created or rode the wave of nostalgia, but his movie, I think, was when kind of the moment where I really feel like the nostalgia came forward, to where it was okay and cool to have 90s ska nostalgia again. And he actually made, I thought, a great film. He really captured it well. And that's great. I'm glad that he made that movie and that kind of gives that to people. But in my opinion, at this point in 2020, 2021, the energy is not in 90s nostalgia, because ska is so much more than what happened for a couple of years in the 90s. And it was true even at the time when people were focusing on six bands. And that's the point I tried to make, that ska has always been more than the trend that it was presented as on MTV, whether you're looking at old bands or looking at new bands. So I think that the new bands on Bad Time Records in this country, and what's happening in other countries, is way more interesting and way more important in terms of the furthering of the genre.
But Aaron, are you mad or are you happy that ska is kind of popular again? Mixed emotions.
Yeah, mixed emotions. I mean, I think it's cool that people are receptive to ska. I just hope people are receptive to hear more about ska than just the nostalgia for the goofy third wave bands. And so far, I see it go both ways. I mean, I hear little podcast pieces from music blogs and stuff. They want to talk about it, and I think they want to go right back to that and that alone. And that part annoys me, because I feel like, I almost feel like the way ska has been treated and made a joke has gotten worse since the 90s. And that's part of what like inspired this book. You know, yeah, at the time it was treated that way. And then when it became uncool by 2000, it was definitely treated like it was just a horrible thing that you ever were involved with. But, you know, decades pass and people just remember the ska, this mainstream ska, like they forget everything else. And then you start seeing jokes on TV shows, like the every show now has a ska joke, and it's always centered on that one idea about it being this goofy trend that everybody got swept up in and then became mortifiably embarrassed about. And I kind of feel like, where's the interest in this being an actual genre where we're looking at it the way we look at every other genre? You know, have these long books analyzing the peculiarities of the different punk subgenres and stuff like that. Or we round up all the hardcore bands and really kind of inspect how each scene had its own culture. Like, where is that with ska? Like, why is ska still reduced to a joke or nostalgia? Like, it seems like the joke is the negative and the nostalgia is the positive, but it all roots in the center of the thing where we're still not treating it like as a real genre that deserves to be discussed with sincere regard.
Go ahead, Adam.
No, I was going to say that's always driven me a little bit crazy. Like when I was like, as I got older and got out of, I think like the most easily targeted sort of teenage ska years, when a lot of that goofy frat music would have resonated more, I think, with my mindset as a, you know, 15-year-old or whatever it was. And I was listening to more, you know, I was listening to more bands like, say, like Hepcat and the Slackers and things like that. And I think that, like, even after ska's like moment in the sun had passed, you had the Slackers that were out there releasing these like crazy live records, or there was like them, and they'd like bring in like Susan Cadogan and people like that, and do all of these like super interesting recordings that you couldn't, that they were like full of life, and that you could never listen to them and think that like, oh, this is goofy. Like there was still levity in it, of course, because it's an upbeat, you know, genre, but there was never a sense that they were taking the piss out of any of it. Right. And that like body of work was never really spoken about outside of people that were just diehards into it was always strange to me. And I wondered if the degree to which the balloon burst reinforced for people that, oh, this was swing, like this was a goofy trend that people were into, because it's not like no one could look around and, you know, in 2005 and say, you know, like, okay, if this wasn't a goofy flash in the pan genre, then like, what are you doing next? Where is everyone? And it was like, well, publicly there wasn't a lot. So I wonder if people took that as, you know, enforcing that their opinion that it was just a goofy thing was right.
Yeah. I mean, the Slackers continue to do well as a band and as an individual band in terms of the, you know, touring and having fans and doing record sales as an indie band. But I think, you know, why weren't they treated with more critical respect? Why weren't they discussed alongside bands of other genres who were regarded by music writers and people who criticize music? And I definitely think the fact that they were in the ska genre affected them, because people felt like ska is not really worth that. Even the good ska is not really worth writing long reviews about and analyzing if it's a good or bad version of the genre. It's just kind of like, well, ska, you know, ska is this dumb thing that happened, and it's got fans. Like a lot of people who dismiss ska, they always say that, well, like, oh, it has its diehard fans, as if like something is wrong with these people for being diehard fans of one specific genre. Doesn't make sense to me. Like, there's so many kinds of genres I'm not super into, but I recognize like 8 artists that do it super well, and I listen to them. Like, the same should be true for ska. Like, all the people that aren't super into ska, they should be super into the handful of bands that are really good at it.
Aaron, here's a question. why are we interested in arguing to people as a whole that ska is valid instead of saying, who cares what you think? I know ska is valid.
I mean, that's a valid question. Like, I'm not, I just think that as a music journalist, it just feels like, why isn't ska part of the rest of every other genre too? Why can't, like, I want people to have a clear understanding of the music's history, its culture, who the better artists are, who the worst artists are. Like, I feel that that should be true of all genres. I mean, this ska's been around since the 50s, and it's changed and evolved through different countries and different time periods. And it's also probably one of the most global genres. And for some reason, that is totally lost on people as well. This music has traveled all over the world. Most countries have, like, grabbed onto it and made it their own in some capacity. And yet for some reason, it's just an ignored thing. So I don't know. I just feel like, as a music fan, why wouldn't we want to have it be portrayed in a more accurate way?
Mm. Adam, I've got a couple of closing questions for Aaron. Do you have any other questions you want to ask him or anything?
No, wrap it up. Good.
Second to last question, Aaron. You talked about ska in different cultures. For Playboy, you actually went down to Mexico and went to, like, a gigantic ska fest. And, like, in parts of Mexico, ska is, like, a massive thing still, right? Or did you go to Southern California? I can't remember.
I went to L.A., so it was, like, the Latino neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and I covered that particular scene of ska.
It's still a vibrant, open, active scene in that community, right?
Correct. Yeah, and it also is extremely huge in Mexico as well. I went to Mexico for my book, and I got to witness one of their festivals, and it was huge, and it was so vibrant, and the bands were unique. And I talked to several of the bands and several of the people, and this idea of ska being thought of as goofy music wasn't part of their thinking at all. In fact, what's interesting about how ska is viewed in Mexico is that most of the bands and the fans come from the poor neighborhoods. And it's almost always political music, and it's politically related to the issues that people in the poor neighborhoods go through and experience. So the stereotype of ska in Mexico is that it's like ghetto music, political ghetto music. It's just so different, but the music doesn't actually sound that different than 90s quote unquote third wave ska. If you just ignore the lyrics and just listen to the music, not very different.
Fascinating. Aaron, you talk about, I guess, current ska not falling prey to perhaps the cliches or the inaccurate labeling. What are some of the poppin' ska bands we should check out now?
I think at the top of the list, you got to go check out Bad Operation from New Orleans. Those guys have been playing ska since the early 2000s in other bands. Then they went away and played some indie rock and some post-punk and stuff like that. And then last year they came back to ska and formed this band, Bad Operation. They've never even played a show yet, because their first show was scheduled in mid-March. So the pandemic shut their first show down. They released their first album last December, and a killer, killer album, kind of in the more two-tone vein of ska.
The punk news listeners and readers are huge fans of Pairs. So at least one of the Pairs guys is in that band, right?
One of the Pairs guys are in that band. All People was another band that the members came from. The singer for that band is like a guitar player for Solange or something. So it's a really interesting group of like experienced musicians, and they're just playing straight up mid-tempo two-tone style ska, but it's really unique too. I also would recommend Cat Bite from Philadelphia.
Hell yeah. They're
very unique band. And I think that a lot of people are already familiar with Ska Tune Network, the Jeremy, who does covers of non-ska songs. But Jeremy has been releasing some original music under the moniker Jer, J-E-R, a couple tracks last year, and a full length is on the way at some point. really interesting, unique stuff too. I think that that's going to be a really good album when that comes out.
How about that band Omnigon I've been reading about? Is that a good band or?
Well, Omnigon, yeah. The only songs I like from them are the two that I play drums on.
Let me ask you one last question, Aaron, and then I'll let you go. I feel, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel as though Adam Davis and yourself are somewhat distancing yourselves from the vast and complicated history of Gnar Boots. Is that accurate?
No. Gnar Boots, we were kind of like, we were a little bit burnt out on shows just before the pandemic. So we were kind of taking a break, and Adam was getting really into Omnigon, and then the pandemic happened, and there's just no way Gnar Boots exists in the live setting. Like 90% of Gnar Boots exist in the live setting. So there's just nothing for us to do during the pandemic. And him and I have talked a lot about, you know, Gnar Boots coming back and doing Gnar Boots shows, but there's no way we can do it until it's 100% safe. We can't do socially distanced shows because a Gnar Boots show is all about invading personal space and getting people to dance and, you know, getting off the stage and into the crowd. So until we get to a place where we're 100% past the virus, Gnar Boots isn't going to come back.
Listen, people, Gnar Boots is, and this is the truth. Gnar Boots shows are some of the craziest shows I've ever seen, in a good way and sometimes in a bad way. An amazing show. I guess I won't retell the 924 Gilman story, but you can read about that on Punk News with my interview with – oh, go ahead, Aaron.
But the thing about Gnar Boots is that during the pandemic, Gnar Boots has transformed into a ska podcast. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, talk briefly about your ska podcast, and then why don't you play a track that you think the listener should hear. So tell us about your ska podcast, and then send us out with a tune.
Okay, so Adam Davis and I from Gnar Boots are doing a podcast called In Defense of Ska. So it's in support of my book, but it's also kind of taking a life of its own. We're interviewing different people in the ska scene, or we're also talking to people who are non-ska musicians who have ska past as well. We interviewed Barry Johnson from Joyce Manor, and he used to be a huge, huge ska fanatic as a teenager, and he told us all about it, and he still loves ska. So, you know, we break it down. We have the long conversations with the ska people. You should definitely check it out. It's available wherever you can stream podcasts, but you can also check out my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. I always post the podcast episodes there. I also post other content, mostly ska related. So let's see. Should we go out on an Omnigon song? Would that be the best way to go? Let's do it. Find it hard to focus, the endless flood of problems never stop. The world is burning, children dying, bigots and the cowards and the cops. And now these dreams will have complete untouched for months until they gather dust. Change today. Clear it all.
And we are back. Adam White. Adam, sorry you didn't get to talk a lot during that segment, so I will give you the floor for the second half of tonight's episode.
Oh, that requires me even knowing what we were going to talk about. Hold on. I'm gonna do a little dance here while I pull up my notes on what we were going to talk about.
I will. Well, actually, honestly, I think I'm like chilling, but honestly, like, the book is rad. Omegon is super rad. So if you like Scott, you should check out that book. Adam, I'll set up the pitch and then I'll let you reply. And that is Penny Rimbaud. Oh, it got taken down. Shit, taken down. Wait, no, maybe it did it. Penny Rimbaud, of course, of Crass. He actually like is on social media fairly frequently, although I think someone else sometimes posts about for him. So I'm not sure if this is his post or the person posting for him. I think it is him, and this really upset a lot of people. On social media, Penny Rimbaud said, this is Penny Rimbaud talking. COVID-19 is the result of genetic tampering, as are the so-called vaccines being employed to counter it. Beneath all this, there is the underlying stench of eugenics. Watch out for Big Pharma brainwash. We are as we are, as nature, that so we be. And if you look at the response, this really upset a lot of people and a lot of anarcho-punk groups. People were like, I hate Penny Rimbaud, F Penny Rimbaud. You know, forget the old bar. It's over. So kind of like linking him up with the whole Rob Miller thing to a degree. I've got very strong feelings on this. Adam, do you want me to kick it off or do you want to respond?
I'm curious what your strong feelings are on this, because when I saw this crop up the other day, I mean, I saw it crop up in a way that I think a lot of people did, which was that I saw other punk people sharing it and sharing it as in like in this like, woof, like, holy shit, look at this. Right. So I took it and I kind of threw it at you because I like seeing you squirm when your various musical heroes do something fucking crazy. So, and you immediately were like, you jumped, you didn't jump to his defense, but you in a way jumped to try to find the angle where you're cool with this or not cool with this, but at least where it is congruent with Penny's past works and persona.
I think you're even overstating my reaction. And like people, I didn't think this is a big deal at all. I think that because of Colin Conflict saying whack out stuff, because of Rob Miller saying whack out stuff, and maybe we bring Rob Miller up too much. It just because it affected me fairly deeply. And a couple of other punkers like freaking out. I think people are like super sensitive, and I definitely think we've lost the perspective that if I disagree with you, I can still disagree with you and still generally respect and like you. Now it's, if you disagree with me, then I have to destroy you, which is where we're at now, which is kind of a bummer. But I didn't think Penny's comment was beyond the pale. And Adam, if maybe I'm missing something, you can explain
it. I mean, I'll parse down my read of it here, right? So, and again, like I'm not, people can have their opinions, but my issue here is that he's not presenting an opinion for the most part. He partially is. And I'll get to the second part in a sec. So the very first thing he says is COVID-19 is the result of genetic tampering, right? Like Penny Rimbaud is not, he doesn't work for a genomics organization. He doesn't know that. That's never been. Yeah, he did not say, I believe that. He said it is, right? He said it is a result of genetic tampering, right?
That bothers you that much?
It bothers me because, and this is the second part, really. This is what it comes out to the part of it. People who are public figures, who have an audience, people that listen to them, people that hang on their words, people that idolize them, they have a certain responsibility, especially when folks are in actual danger, or at least danger of making decisions that are going to harm others, of not spewing off whatever dumb shit that they can think of because it's going to harm people. So him coming out and declaring that COVID is the, let me talk, that COVID is the result of genetic tampering, right? So for him to go on to say that, again, which has no basis in any scientific anything that I've seen or read, right? That in and of itself is throwing fuel onto the fire of this like anti-vax, anti-expertise, anti-science thing that has poisoned the whole conversation about goddamn everything over the past 10 years. So for him to go and to declare something like that is dangerous. It's a bad thing to do. So then he goes and he says,
So he says, okay, so are the vaccines being employed to counter it? Well, yeah, I get that vaccines are the result of tampering because it's a human made thing. Science is creating the vaccine. So yeah, okay, sure. But to go and just to declare the virus is the result of genetic tampering is just irresponsible and founded in nothing. So he's got that. So then he loops
it's
that.
It's not founded in nothing.
It's founded in nothing. Nothing that the WHO or that the U.S. authorities that have been looking into this, or that any respectable scientific organization has come out and said that there is any evidence that humans sat down and created COVID in a lab somewhere. Like, that's all hogwash and horseshit, and it feeds in to this. It feeds into the sentiment that is going to take us longer to get out of this, which is that people aren't going to trust what the scientists are selling them because they think there's a conspiracy behind everything, right? So then he loops this in the same, like, these are like three sentences that he posted, right? He loops this into eugenics into the next sentence, right? And which, again, so he's setting up this big evil straw man of things that he's trying to fight against. And then he loops it into the watch out for big pharma. And you know what? Yeah. Watch out for big pharma. Of course. Like, if we're going to make this a thing about like anti-corporatism, then sure. I don't think anyone's going to approach that. But by looping that all in together, by making it all this one statement, it doesn't have any particular interesting subtlety that anyone should read out of it. It sounds like he has sympathies with all of these anti-scientific kook theories that are floating around on the internet that are going to help no one. So when we have a certain responsibility right now to make sure the public is actually informed about what's going on and how we're going to get out of this. And if you are a famous person and you're going to go and spew dumb bullshit into the world, then you are going to potentially convince some fraction of your followers and diehards to either believe that shit or to go down a road on the internet where they're going to be exposed to more and more, more and more lies, more and more other horse shit. And it's going to poison the well of what we should be understanding about how to fight this thing as a unit. So, like, I get being suspicious of corporations. And if you want to found everything in that, then sure, in a lot of times we should be suspicious of corporations. But in this case where we as a society, to get back to where we were going to, we need a vaccine for this thing, and we need the vaccine to be understood and properly vetted by scientists and then, properly communicated out to the public by the government. It does not help if we have our celebrities out there, coming up with this, like, dumb uncle bullshit and putting it on the internet. It's bad.
I disagree with a lot of what you're saying. First of all, let's be clear. I definitely think COVID is a real thing, and I definitely think vaccine is probably the way, is a major way to combat against it. That being said, I'm able to disagree with Penny Rimbaud without calling him stupid like Adam. Penny Rimbaud is not stupid. I do think Penny Rimbaud is actually providing a very valuable service in that one of the most interesting things that I found is that when the Republicans had a majority, everyone's like, distrust the government, hate the government, destroy the government. The government doesn't have your best interest. Kind of true. Very, very true in many circumstances. But now that Trump is gone, everyone's like, trust the government. The government is looking out for you. I don't know if, and I don't people think I'm not that at all. All I'm saying is Penny Rimbaud is issuing the concept of, there is no authority but yourself. Think for yourself. Big Pharma is not looking out for you. In this one circumstance, it is in Big Pharma's interest to work with the government to fight this vaccine. So just because something's in Big Pharma's best interest doesn't mean it's against our best interest, but it usually is. And so I think Penny Rimbaud is saying, just because this is happening, don't accept that Big Pharma is looking out, because they're not. Big Pharma is. And Adam's like, it will be different if he said, my opinion is that COVID is a result of genetic tampering. Adam setting the rule that anytime you have an opinion, you have to preface it with, my opinion is. Everyone knows Penny Rimbaud's opinion. Everyone knows that Penny Rimbaud is not a scientist. Penny Rimbaud lives in a cottage in woods in England, and he has for the past 50 years. So for Adam to say that it's responsible for Penny Rimbaud, I think it's scary that Adam is the idea that any famous person must issue the exact same message as mandated by the majority of people, or else, you know, be punished for that. That's the, and that people can't make decisions for themselves. Adam's big argument was, well, if they hear Benjamin Ballard saying this, then they'll go in and hear this from this person. You have to give people personal accountability, and you have to trust that people are able to make decisions for themselves. And so we can't govern ourselves by saying people must be controlled or babied or only given certain messages. The foundation of, you know, I mean, I realize Pennington Bowers in England and Adams in Canada, but the foundation of United States, first clause of First Amendment, free speech, you know, and both Canada and England have somewhat, though not as powerful, corollaries, whatever that word is. And so I can't agree that we should force people to say the same thing all around just because certain people think it's in their best interest. I definitely think, and actually, I actually think that that is dangerous and shows that your own thing is weak. If you don't believe that the truth can withstand criticism, then your truth is not strong and it probably isn't the truth. I think we all know what the truth is. COVID is a real thing, and the vaccine is a very important way to counteract as a social distance. And if that can't stand up to scrutiny, then what does that say about the truth that we have? So I don't agree with anything about it here, but I think it is important that he is reminding us grass message for the past 40 years has been question the government, don't trust the government, and think for yourself. And just because we think the government is acting in our best interest right now does not mean that we should drop the guard of and immediately trust whatever the government says. Now, in this case, like I said, I do believe that, you know, vaccine and social distancing is important, but we don't want to immediately say, you're right, everything they say is absolutely, but I won't question it at all.
And John, you got to own up to killing your idols a little bit here. I mean, I don't care if he's a co-founder of one of the most famous punk acts and that this punk act has meant a lot to a lot of people and they've done a lot of good in the world. He's saying wrong horse shit. And the wrong horse shit is dangerous. Well, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be allowed to say it. I'm just saying that everyone is right to call him out for being a giant asshole for even attempting to do this in this way. Like, you should not need to have to parse out the values of this statement. It's wrong.
You're demonizing and trying to destroy anybody that disagrees with you, which is a very poor way to be intellectual. You know,
he is going to hurt people with this, John.
He's not trying to hurt people. Many people think that, you know, genetic tampering with food and so forth is the result of why health is so poor. I don't know if it is or it isn't. I think that's certainly something to consider. That's why organics is so big right now. You know, and that's the underlying message he's doing here.
That is not the underlying message of what he's doing. He's spreading fear and uncertainty and doubt about things that he knows nothing about. You're giving him a pass on this under the reed of, well, free speech is valuable to the American experiment. Like, that's not the right read on this. Like,
yes, we're, it is the right read on
it. John.
I'm willing to sacrifice speech quite easily. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do.
He can say this, but he's a giant fucking asshole for doing it.
Well, I mean, you can say that. I think that's not a good way to respond when people disagree with your position. Especially here when I don't think he's being malicious. I think what he's saying is the government has not been trustworthy towards him for the past. He has not been trustworthy to the government, and the government has done shady things for the past 40 years. You can't disagree with that. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a right side guy or deep state or any of that. I'm actually probably more trustworthy of the government than most people, honestly, to a degree. But that being said, is Pennington Bowd is saying, don't forget that concept.
John, you're ascribing far too much virtue onto someone being a dummy. I don't know how else to tell us to go on that.
You immediately, instead of defending your point, you just say Pennington Bowd's a jackass, the dummy.
He is using his platform, whether he is aware of it or not, to throw fuel onto a fire that is going to lead to more people being harmed.
So you're saying that if someone is famous or has notoriety, that their platform has to conform to what the majority thinks.
I'm saying if someone is famous and there is an ongoing crisis, that they should think before they go inject their opinion into the public sphere about that, about whether they are going to make the situation worse for people in a way that could actually have tangible effects on people's lives. And in this case, he could.
You think Penny Rambow's opinion is really going to affect that many people?
I don't know how many people he's talking to on the internet, but if you have people that are already being fed all of this misinformation from all corners, it doesn't help to have someone's, you know, potential musical hero all of a sudden show up and start exposing things that are going to read along those same lines. Like Penny's opinion on this helps no one. It serves no purpose. It does not strike. It does not strike. From there is absolutely a conversation that we can be having about the trustworthiness of pharma corporations and the role and the role that they're going to play, you know, in solving this crisis and in coming out of this. But that's not the way that he's approached this point.
But you don't know that. You were ascribing that.
I know because I read it. That's what he wrote. That's the first five words of what he says. There is the first thing in the statement is that he goes and he says that, like, what is it? That COVID is genetically engineered, right? So, like, the very first few lines out of it are a lie, are misinformation. And then eventually he gets into talking about pharma. If he actually wanted to make a point about pharma corporations, he could have done that without starting his statement with something that is demonstrably false by everyone that's investigated into it so far. He's speaking to kook shit YouTubers who are spreading bad ideas around each other.
You're immediately associating him with those QAnon guys.
Because he's spitting out the same level of garbage. I don't care if he was in Crass or not.
You're implying intention that is not there on a plain reading of his statement. And that's on you. That's not on him.
John, if I went and I got you a statement from some QAnon crazy person, would you be making the same argument that we can't discount the QAnon crazy person's bullshit because, you know, yes, you can parse out something that might be a useful point?
You're oversimplifying the situation, and the reason you're doing that is because you know the argument is falling apart. The difference there is if you give me a QAnon statement, I'm aware of this person's background and what they said in the past and how it all links together. Here, likewise, you have to associate Penny Rambaud's background and then how that links together. You can't separate this one statement from his vast history of the things that he's discussed and talked about. Do I think he's wrong? Yes. But do I think he's malicious or should be violent or should be destroyed? No. Penny Rambaud, he's telling to be wrong once in a while.
John, if that's your read on it, I don't know about you. I've been stuck in a house for a fucking year, and I do not need anyone to take their celebrity position and to make this 1 second worse for me. There are numerous other voices that could have a far more impactful conversation about the point that you're trying to parse out of this than what it is.
You're making, Adam, is that you are trying to sacrifice a short-term benefit, violence to Penny Rambaud or destroying Penny Rambaud or not letting these people say these kinds of things, which certainly probably would have a short-term benefit. But in the long run, that, when applied at a greater scale, would have far more ranging destruction than you could even.
John, if I could save one life, I would never read a Penny Rambaud Facebook message again.
If you could save one life, you would never read a Penny Rambaud. I don't know what that means, Adam.
If silencing Penny Rambaud's missives on Facebook would save one extra life in this pandemic, then I would take that and accept the fact that free speech has been squashed.
That's the error that you're making. Because by applying that tool here, and by applying that here, you will cost far more lives in the future. Just look at the Chinese government.
Yeah, Penny Rambaud's kooky Facebook messages are keeping the Chinese government from taking over. Is that
no? You're missing the point. The point being is when you silence anybody that disagrees with you, then you set up a chain where people can't express what they want, and you allow fascism to take over and control what people can say. And that's the tool that you're willing to apply for a short-term benefit as opposed to thinking about the long-range damage that tool would do.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. I was pacing around and I totally pulled my mic out of my
thing. So I don't know where I went.
So mad you were pacing around?
Mm-hmm.
We're so mad that you were pacing around?
I'm always pacing around. I'm not a chair person.
Listen, Adam, I think we're at loggerheads, and I think, Adam, as people that mutually respect each other, I think we can agree to disagree with each other's stance as regards to Pendulum Bound State.
Oh, yeah, totally. So here's what we want you to do, folks. If you think that John is being a kook, send $5 to John Gentile at punknews.org. If you think that I'm being a kook, send $10 to Adam at punknews.org. And
no, but Adam, the way we should do that is if people think I'm being a kook, they should send you money. And if they think you're being a kook, they should send me money. Because otherwise, you're encouraging us to develop our own QAnon to improve our own profit. You see.
Yeah, I really should have thought through the pyramid scheme aspects of this before we started. In any case, here's what you should do. Yeah, podcastthepunknews.org is where we want your email, so we would like you to write in about those things and tell us what's going on. What do we got to talk about here outside of
let's talk about something fun. How about that?
We could.
Or do we want to talk about a true QAnon guy? You want to do something fun or a true QAnon guy, Adam?
No, you know, let's hold the true QAnon guy, because, like, is there anything to say, like, the Ice Earth thing?
Yeah, I guess not. Let's talk about punk rock bowling.
Yes.
Punk rock bowling. And actually, this does link to our previous stories. Punk rock bowling, I would say, somewhat boldly declared that it's going to happen this year, September 24 to 26. Late last year, the proclamation was there might be live shows in the fall, but now a lot of people say they're not going to live shows until 2022. That being said, playing Punk Rock Bowling 2021 tentatively, Devo, NoFX Circle Jerk. Devo's replacing Madness. I think NoFX might be replacing Coxbar. I can't really quite remember. There's also going to be the Streetlight Manifesto, Lunatics, Propaganda, Municipal Waste, Lawrence Arms, Anti-Flag, Bronx, Roy Ellis, Agrolite, Youth Shade, and let's see who am I missing here. Good Riddance, a Horror, Plague Bender, Pears, Bishop Green, Bridge City, Celeste Gang, Adam White. Do you think Punk Rock Bowling 2021 will take place? And is this appealing to you?
Oh, it's appealing as hell to me from a lineup standpoint. I mean, like, there's some crazy stuff on here, like a Devo Circle Jerks propaganda show. Like, that's nuts. There's so much cool stuff that is in the lineup of this. You know, you get this, you know, like the Bronx Youth Brigade, Lawrence Arms, like I'm you know, no effects. I'm all about this. I would have a ball at this thing. That said, like, I don't know, like, does it? It just, nothing feels real right now, right? Like, what immediately jumped out on me is I'm looking at this and, like, it's September, right? So it's not super deep into the fall or anything like that. It's like it's just near the end of September. And so, like, Propaganda's on the list here, and, like, right now, like, the border is closed. Like, you cannot go to the United States from Canada unless you're like, could they go on some, like, vacation flight? Like, maybe? Like, I'm not totally certain about the rules. Like, the land borders are all closed right now between Canada and the States. We're definitely not supposed to go places. That said, a few of our politicians have gotten in trouble for, like, absconding to the Dominican Republic during the, you know, while everyone else was on lockdown. So I guess you can go to the States. So maybe they have a way to get down there. But that was my first read, was that, like, if things aren't better by that point where the borders are open again, like, how do they get from A to B, just from a logistics standpoint? But,
well, I think if borders weren't open, they would not go,
but presumably, I don't know. Anyways, though, that's I mean, that's the travel plans of Propaganda are maybe a moot point to look at this. It doesn't feel real. Like, maybe it doesn't feel real from the Canadian perspective, only because we're so far behind in the vaccine game compared to you guys. Like, you might be there. Like, the numbers that are coming online for a lot of this stuff are pretty crazy. So there's a good chance that by the end of the summer, you will have a safe majority of Americans vaccinated enough that you could open up, like, a fucking music festival in Las Vegas.
And if so, then, you know, that's what we want, right? Canada, that's I saw a statistic or something right now where they said that, like, and this isn't Canada wide, this is, I guess, just Ontario, but like Ontario right now, because there are no vaccines in the country at the moment, or very few, you know, we're vaccinating something like it's maybe 8,000 to 10,000 people a day in Ontario. And if you wanted to get to the point where all of the adults in Ontario were vaccinated by the end of September, you'd have to be doing at least 50,000 a day. And that's just not happening at the moment. And that may really, and the rest of Canada is in the same sort of boat. So that might ramp up by a huge amount once spring happens and the vaccines that we've purchased actually start arriving. But right now, like every day is just like gaze at the numbers and you know, react in despair that we're not getting further along. So to see anything planned at all, to see anything planned past like Friday is just so strange. But John, let's say that things are maybe not like, okay, let me back up there. I'll ask your opinion on that in a sec. Do you think it's going to happen? I guess, first of all,
I don't think, or if it does happen, then it'll be like quote socially distanced or whatever. And it'll be like 1/4 capacity or something. I think it's wishful thinking. I think because they didn't have one last year or in the fall or in this spring, they're almost 2 years behind. They're a year and a half behind. So they need money bad. So I think they're really hoping, but I don't see that.
Yeah. Like that's what I've been trying. I'm trying to figure out like, what's the game if you are a festival and you do have to make some sort of declaration about what you're doing, you know, this summer, let alone this fall. Right. So like everyone that canceled last summer, I've got to imagine at least around my area, like they're going to have to cancel for this summer. And do you just do it and do the same thing that you did last year where you have these virtual concerts and live streams and stuff like that? Or do you just hit the pause button and like roll back around in 2022 when things actually will be normal? Like, I don't know if there is I don't know what the economic argument is for it. Like, if they just skip, do you lose so much momentum from like a branding and publicity standpoint that it's suicide? Like, I feel like there might not be any good answer there.
And the other side of that is when things open back up, is it going to be like a shit show? Like, are people going to freak out?
Like freak out because they're rapturous and they just want to get there, or freak out because like they're terrified to be in a crowd. Because I can see
like punk rock hypothetically represents the first time that a lot of people can get drunk in a public setting, which a lot of people like. So is it going to be like a shit show with like fist fights and like people going crazy and people making out, or is it going to be like a slow ramp up so it won't seem that much of a shock? You know?
I don't know. Like I'm curious about. That's going to be a fascinating thing. Is like what is it going to be like to, you know, walk into a crowded restaurant with where everyone's unmasked and it's just like it was, and you like the first time that you have to do that, right? And just not that you're going to walk in and somehow be fearful of it, because if things are better, they're better, right? But more so, like, is it going to be off-putting? Like, is it going to seem like too, like something we need to get used to again?
Adam, how desperate are you? Like, are you bugging out or are you like chilling out?
I'm definitely yearning for it, and it's, I'm yearning for it in a way where like I would want to do it. I hate half measures. Like I don't want to. I realize that bands don't have a lot of options right now, but I really don't want to watch anyone's live stream. Like it's just not a
it just doesn't fit my schedule of life right now. Like they're never happening when I would actually be around. I can't ever seem to line up with them. And then when they are happening and I could potentially watch them, it always comes down to that I'm just not in that headspace. Like, you know, am I going to sit down and watch a movie with my wife, or am I going to tune into this guy who I otherwise appreciate as an artist, but they're going to try to make a shitty, you know, Instagram live video? Or am I going to sit down and make my family suffer through that instead of watching something that's, you know, been properly produced for film, you know? And I can't do that. And all these things that people are trying to like clever their way around never seem appealing to me. Have they been doing like the drive-in concerts around you? Like, have you?
I like optimism, but it's just kind of stupid.
I couldn't see pulling up my like Toyota into a big field and I don't know, like sitting with the back hatch open and watching a band play 500 feet away from me with like 12 other cars in front of me. It just doesn't seem, I mean, if it was down the street, I guess I'd do it for lack of anything else, but I wouldn't go out of my way to go to one of those things. I'd love to go see some shitty band play in a basement somewhere when it's safe. Like I want the real thing, John. I want the real experience.
Honestly, like, I'm chilling out, and I know that's the wrong perspective. Like, I love going to shows. I'm not bragging, but I probably go to more shows than anybody else that we have on the podcast. Like, when things are kicking, I go to, like, 4 to 8 shows a month, you know. I guess, like, Scott Hyde was more than that, doesn't he? You know. But I'm kind of just chilling out and enjoying, like, not a slower pace of things, but I guess I have more free time, I guess, because I'm not going out. But that's the wrong perspective, because, I mean, honestly, I'm two prime concert-going years of my life. You know what I mean? Like, when you're 75, you're not going to shows 8 times a week. You know what I mean? So it's a bummer, I guess. It's a bummer, but it doesn't feel like a bummer. And I'm not saying that COVID is a tragedy and it's a big issue. But I'm saying, from the perspective of me having more time in my house, more time to stay up late at night doing writing instead of going out, I'm not hating that, but I should put up that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd feel better just chilling out until this was all done. This is our problem right now at home here, and I'm going to put on my socialist hat here, but like, I'd have a lot easier time with this if the government would just pony up and pay people to stay home and not go put themselves into dangerous situations, but actually pony up the cash to make it happen. Because then you wouldn't have all these edge cases, artists in particular, that we got to feel are getting a raw deal here. Like let's say you're an artist. And you, of course, can't tour right now, which is your main source of income, because, you know, no one's paying you from Spotify or anything like that. So, because you're an artist, you're technically like intermittently employed. You don't necessarily have all the benefits that someone that has been like contributing into the employment insurance system would if they were laid off from their job and all that. Like if the government was just paying these people to, you know, put everything on ice for as long as it takes for us to get out of this, then I'd feel a lot less bad about, you know, missing their crappy live stream or something like that, because I know that like they're not relying on that to put food on the table. So I, you know, the more of my tax dollars and my children's and children's and children's tax dollars I can throw at bands, I'd be happy to do that right now just to kind of get us out to the other side of it. It's that same argument right now that's being made kind of like all over the world about, you know, whether we're going to sacrifice, you know, lives for the sake of the economy. And it's like, well, you wouldn't have to make that decision if we could save lives and just, you know, dump money onto those people that have to make that poor choice. So yeah,
I don't know, John. I would the thing that I am curious about though is that how could something like punk rock bowling here happen where there is a where you have to make the choice as the fan, and the choice is difficult. I'm trying to come up like what the scenario would be where there's a difficult choice. So let's say things are a little bit, let's say things are marginally better, but there's flare-ups and outbreaks all over the place. And let's say the health authorities are saying people should not gather in these events, but let's say the great state of Nevada says, fuck you, we got to feed people, so we're letting people do things, and it's going to be a, you know, do it at your own risk event, right? If we had somehow that strange middle ground where you'd have to make a series of risk assessments, you know, am I going to go to this airport? Am I going to get on this plane? Am I going to go in the crowd of this show? And we're still in a situation where, you know, there's people that are masked and there's people that are defiant and not masked. And, you know, we can't.
That's like, the worst. Like when you see like Tough Guy Jones at the gas station, he's not wearing the mask and always wearing it like below his chin to be a dick. I mean, sometimes I say something, sometimes I don't. It's like, do I want to get shot over this bullshit? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I don't know if I'd want to have to make that series of risk assessments to go see NoFX. Right? But if it turns out that it's like, you know what, we're all adequately vaccinated and it's fine, then I'd totally fucking go see NoFX, so...
I'm sad that Madness. I mean, I understand why, but I wish Madness. Like, I would so expect Madness.
Yeah, but
a year ago.
Sure, but I am too. But like Devo.
That's true. That's honestly, like I'm not trying to be weird. Now's the time to see Devo because like two of the main guys have passed away, right, Adam? So like, if you're going to see Devo, now's the time.
Yeah, then this is my personal preference coming in here. Somehow over the past like 3 years, Devo has like rocketed up to become one of my favorite bands. And there's just like any extra Devo content I can introduce into my life is what I want. So that was my first reaction. Even before the part of my brain that was like, oh, is this actually going to happen? My immediate reaction upon seeing this poster was like, woo, Devo. So,
one thing about punk, and like I said, we are not sponsored by punk rock bowling anymore, which makes it all that much more humorous now that I like love punk rock bowling. But for some reason, like headlining bands like do killer sets at punk rock bowling. Like when Iggy Pop played punk rock bowling, his set was maybe the best solo set he'd done in like 15 years. It was like all Stooges hits, the first two album hits, and like a couple of tracks from like Repo Man and Kill City. And like that was it. Like none of his like late 80s, 90s bullshit. It was like pure Iggy perfection. He usually doesn't do that, and it was like the best set he ever played. So, you know, I'm trying to think. Well, Flag only has some song. Rant set list was like all killer. When I saw the Dwarves play punk rock bowling, it was by far the best time I'd ever seen. They did all of Young and Good Looking, and then basically all their hardcore tracks straight in a row. Bands playing punk rock bowling for whatever reason do amazing sets. So I think like this Devo set would be like a killer set.
I agree, and it would be nice to see. All right, John, we are super long.
And this is one hell of an episode, honestly. This was one hell of an episode, and honestly, I didn't know that you felt so strongly about Penny Room Bound. I almost wonder if I would have picked my strategy different had I known that. But
I mean, you
messaged me in like kind of like a joking way. I thought.
Well, no, it's more that I think that I initially latched onto it just because I wanted to see you squirm, right? But it was
but then I didn't squirm, and that made you mad.
No, well, no, but then I'm thinking about it, and his statement bothered me, I think, more than I wanted. But God, I love arguing with you about stuff. So that was good. I feel like I got a good stretch in. You know,
Adam, you know what? We clash once in a while, but I say we don't ever really compliment each other, and guys kind of don't do that, you know. And I think maybe you might even do it less than me. I only have brothers, right?
What was that? Sorry?
You only have brothers, right?
Yeah, I have a brother.
But you have a sister or you don't have a sister?
No, I don't.
Yes, so I wonder if sometimes I take what Adam says a little personally just because he has brothers. And maybe brothers are rougher with each other if it's the only brothers. Anyway, Adam, I will say I appreciate you as a fellow podcaster. I think you are an extremely intelligent person, extremely thoughtful person. And I appreciate that you and I can rumble, but not take it personal. And not only rumble, but in good day, in good sport. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, John, I appreciate that too. And I think that's maybe one of the things that people seem to like about this show is that like we can have differing opinions on things and not have it blow up in our faces. Considering all the audio mishaps that we had during our interview earlier, that was by far not the most problematic part of this show when it comes to actually assembling it. Let me tell you.
Adam, were you annoyed by my pack? I'm glad I got that off my chest, honestly.
Is it questionable that you opened an interview by airing your weird internet beef with someone for 15 minutes? Potentially. Yes.
To be fair, though, my history, I've interviewed Arbor twice for this. And both interviews have been jokingly combative. So,
hey, if they keep coming back, then that's just fine. Everyone should absolutely go check out the book and check out the In Defense of Ska podcast, which they have out about the book. And I mean, I can't wait to sit down and read this thing in full. Punk News posted a sample chapter of it back in December that focused on the
Propaganda Ska Sucks.
Propaganda Ska Sucks and the band a Whole Lot of Milka, which was like a Winnipeg ska band at the time. That is a super horrible name.
Terrible name,
but kind of like par the course for that particular era in our lives.
What does that name mean? Like, I don't even know what that name means. Whole Lot of Milk.
I don't know. They're one of those bands that whenever they showed up on one of these like Canadian ska compilations that we would have picked up back in the day, like even at the height of it, like we knew in our hearts that some of these band names were just like beyond the pale dumb. And you couldn't do anything about it, right? Like if you were going to wear the pork pie hat and the checkered pants and dance around and all that, you had to take the good with the bad. So you had to take your Mephiscopheles and everything at the same time that you took your slackers. And you know, that was just life. All right, do you got a song to kill this? What are we gonna do?
Well, I mean, I'll let you play something, or if not, then maybe we'll. Oh, I know. Let's play a Roy song. Right around the Jamaican ska period, one of the earliest chatters / dance hall / toasters. So let's just do a U Roy track. Who just passed away, sadly. R.I.P. U Roy. This is U Roy doing Chalice. Chalice. Yeah.